So, who wants to offer a little insight on that?
I kind of, like, obviously it was dated, but I kind of just wanted to, like, bring the question of, like, the problems that the EU may have. Like, not just these, but any others. So, if you guys want to talk about
it. Yeah, I mean, I think now one of the major problems of the EU is the refugee crisis, obviously. And I think we were talking about this last meeting as well, but just the fact that they're all expected to bring in a proportional amount of refugees or the same amount of refugees, but some countries think they shouldn't have to, and then that makes them feel special in comparison to other countries, and it's not fair, really. So I think that's kind of a major threat to the integrity of the EU right now.
How do you see that, like, being resolved?
I really think that it's got to be, like, you're either all in or you're all out kind of thing. Because you, for a country like Hungary or Poland or something, you can't say that, oh, the EU is a good thing and this trade and this free movement of people is all great for our country and our economy and everything, but we don't want to really have to deal with these refugees. And meanwhile, you have France and Italy and Germany saying, oh yeah, we love all these things too, but we do have to deal with these refugees. So it's not fair for those countries that are very accepting of the problem to have to deal with it, and yet the countries that aren't accepting of the problem still have the same benefits, you know? So, like I said, it's either countries like Hungary and Poland either have to accept the fact that they have to bring in these refugees, or they can find their own currency and trade with other nations how they want to.
Excuse me, Maddie.
I was just going to say, like, so would you say it would have to be, like, a proportional rate to, like, population or GDP?
Yeah, I think it should be, like, all things considered, because obviously more developed countries or more economically well-off countries can deal with the more refugees. So I get why Poland, for example, isn't so accepting of it. But what really irked me about the whole thing was when the Prime Minister of Hungary built a wall along the border and then said that they weren't accepting the refugees because they were afraid of the Islamification of Europe. Where this shouldn't be seen as an Islam problem, it should be seen as a humanitarian crisis. And not obviously Hungary can't take the amount of refugees that France or Germany can, but even taking 50,000 or 25,000 is better than taking absolutely none, you know?
If you believe that that all the countries in the EU should take an equal proportion of the refugees, whether it's a proportion to their own population or a proportion as literally all taking the same amount, you're kind of commodifying the refugees and you're saying that you don't really have a choice in where you're going to go. And it's not that they necessarily... I don't know. Here's a question. Do you think that they deserve a choice in saying where they go? Because on one hand, we're still... but on one hand, the EU is still giving them a new home and saying, oh, obviously you're a refugee. You need somewhere to go. We'll give you somewhere to go. But at that point, is it fair to just send them to whichever country needs that certain amount of people?
I'd say that's fair.
I don't think it's on do they deserve to have a right in picking where they go. I think it's do they deserve to have the right to leave where they are in the moment.
Yeah.
So I think maybe it's your, like, the angle that you're looking at it from. It's not necessarily like, oh, we want to get out of our, we want to go on vacation. You know, it's the sort of thing where it's like, we want to leave where we are now and we deserve the opportunity to do so. Because their concern isn't really with where they're going as long as it's better than where they are.
Which I agree with, but if you are a senior refugee, and let's say, you know, the next place for you to go is in Europe, but you might have a preference to go to a certain country because maybe you have family there, or maybe there's a higher demand for whatever kind of work you're specialized in, and then the EU just says, oh, well, we have to send a certain percentage of you to, you know, Czechoslovakia.
I think that's the whole point of the application process, though, is that I think they try, like, at least they have those preferences taken into account. It's just, you're right, at the end of the day, I think it's just about where can go without putting stress on the, like, the each individual country, and, you know, hopefully helping as many people as you can, because it's about the stability concept. As long as you're not getting blown up, like, it's better than nothing, right?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's not, they don't say,
like,
oh,
like, you don't need to work to go somewhere else. You just need to live, essentially.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to moderate this for a second. This is the second or third time that we've taken a conversation that's not about the migrant crisis and made it entirely about the migrant crisis. So I'm just gonna steer this a little bit. Stagnating economy, Ukraine Russia crisis, Brexit. Okay, and we kind of already discussed Brexit last session. So we actually have a very special opportunity here. We have at least 4 economic background students here with us today. So how about we just look at that for a little bit? Is there any economic insight into this?
I like that.
The stagnating.
Right. So right now the Eurozone is pretty much stagnating. They have something which is called the little pigs. Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain, although some people are now saying it should be fig, because France is going down too and Portugal's not so bad and things like that. I think it should be figs, because I still think that Spain is doing
better. Spain's economy is doing better.
Is it doing better?
Yeah.
Okay. I need to read up on that. So they're saying that those countries are, I don't want to say they're dragging down the euro, but they are experiencing stagnation, and then I think that this article talks about that, and it also talks about possible sanctions with Russia coming up, which could really hurt their economy even further. So, with that very brief background.
On the topic of Russia, I don't see it really being realistic if there'd be a whole lot of sanctions against Russia, because I'm pretty sure they're one of the largest world exporters of energy.
Yeah,
sorry.
Europe gets most of its energy from Russia.
Yeah. And I really don't see them experience the same standards of living, I guess I could say. But I guess beyond the topic of Russia, I think that considering that the EU has so many different countries and so many different different developing economies, even though the EU is one economy, it's also made up of so many different small economies. I think that a stagnating European economy is always going to be a perceived pitfall. Because you can't not worry about the economy. You have 28 countries that are all trying to work under the same currency. It's just always going to be a top priority. At least I think. But I'm also an economist.
Especially now that Britain has left the EU. Britain was responsible for the absolute largest part of the pie as far as the wealth behind the euro.
Britain wasn't part of the euro.
Sorry, not the euro. The EU. And then they had funds. So, like, Britain was giving money for, like, healthcare and things like that.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I still think, at least since the time that this was written, like, Germany has certainly stepped up to the plate in the last year or two, like, as I think we kind of discussed before everybody got in here. So they're kind of, like, poised to take that position and kind of run with it, considering, you know, the UK is like, oh, we're not going back, but really they're going to, like, kill themselves in the process. I really don't see the point of it personally, but you know, that's certainly something that's changed that nobody like had necessarily predicted at this point. I can't believe this was like 2 years ago that people were figuring this out already. I mean, props to you economics majors
that this was going to happen. They predicted Brexit, like they even
named
it like 2 years prior to
like,
a year ago.
It's kind of been a long time coming, which
I wouldn't put that on economists, because I don't think Brexit was really... I mean, they kind of mask it as being an economics issue, but it was really just geared towards, you know...
Well, that's how they
it's
got,
like
that's how they got
the
rhetoric across,
exactly.
But that was for the public. I mean, at least the government level, they wanted to cut off from the European Union regardless.
Well, I think for the public, it wasn't... I think for the public, it was a kind of silent majority that was more geared towards the refugee crisis and the general...
Yeah, that's the general population. there are still, you know, there's like the explicit and the implicit causes, and I think that those both existed at the same time, and that's why this happened.
Yeah, I think this particular situation is a really good setup for a discussion between an economist and an IR person, because you have this puzzle which has two very distinct sides to it, and I'm just quickly outlining this from the original article right here. When it comes to, and this is specifically dealing with Ukraine and Russia, when it comes to dealing with this, a lot of people are saying that the EU and as a whole NATO needs to have a strong response to what Russia's doing with Ukraine, because the EU has already been really lax with how the Iraqi and Syrian crises have been handled. And so someone who's an IR would probably say that, you know, Russia's pretty much been giving the run of the litter. And someone who is in economics would look at the fact that they've already tried to, again, this was a while ago, but they already did pass several minor sanctions against Moscow, and they hurt the EU just as bad as they could have hurt Moscow. So I think that it's, you know, having a healthy economy, in my personal opinion, my personal background, is step one, and then you can worry about how those economies are interacting. But someone who is an IR would obviously say people first, and you need to, you know, make sure that people are not taking over each other, obviously.
I think a good way for European Union countries to, I guess, punish Russia without actually sanctioning them would be to lessen their dependence on Russian sources of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would also double as a good opportunity for economic growth through the expansion of industries like solar or wind power, which could then create jobs by...
So pull a Denmark.
Aren't they kind of heading that up anyway, though?
Yeah.
They're trying.
Well, yeah, Denmark's really trying.
Yeah, there's Denmark, like those Scandinavian countries that are always...
There's way more...
it's that Scotland has gotten a lot of power from wind turbines lately, but I'm sure Germany gets... more than enough power from it, but if they were to diminish their reliance on Russian gas and oil while increasing their own sector of energy, then it could be like a 1-2 punch of harming Russia's economy while strengthening Europe's.
Absolutely. It's kind of like a long-term project in comparison to like...
Yeah.
They already had to deal with Britain leaving. It's like, how do you handle that and have the money to do anything when one of your biggest sources of income is, like, about to die out?
Well,
to dry up.
The other thing, too, is that with the leaving, with the Brexit, we also saw that Scotland and Northern Ireland really didn't want to leave. So there's a potential for that in the coming years for, yeah, maybe England and Wales stay out of the European Union, but then you get Scotland and Northern Ireland, or maybe Northern Ireland comes back into the Republic or whatever. But you get Scotland back, and Scotland was a huge source of scientific and technological advancements within the EU, and a huge reason why Scotland decided to stay in the UK in the first place was because the UK told them, if you don't leave, we won't leave. But then the UK turned around and they left anyway.
Yeah, so what are the chances that that's going to happen?
Well, now that the UK went back on saying, okay, we won't leave the European Union, I'd say the chances that Scotland holds another referendum within the next 2 years and then actually votes to leave are pretty good. And then I guess you could see the whole leaving the European Union as setting precedent for Scotland leaving the UK, because if the UK wants to leave the European Union against the wishes of Scotland, then they can't really say anything when Scotland wants to leave the UK against the wishes of England, you know?
Well, I mean, they could, they're England,
and
they should.
But they can they make a case for their own, like, self-determination and everything, right? Like, that's not really a matter of discussion. It's just kind of like a whether or not they want to do it.
Yeah, I think...
Are there any...
I think the, main argument against it would be territorial integrity for the UK.
Yeah.
But I think a good counter argument to that would be Scotland historically has been a different state than the UK, than England has, and that they're also they might be the same state right now, but they're two separate nations.
Yeah, and the governments are different.
Yeah, and they have their own separate governments and everything,
right.
So...
It's just the association.
It's like a, almost like a smaller European Union.
Yeah.
It's like a Britain Union, but Scotland leaving.
Oh, like the United
Kingdom.
Oh my
god. No way.
Certainly, this is like a different environment than what we are dealing with in this whole article, but I think we did a pretty good job of framing current problems. And yeah, a lot of things keep coming up, like migration and like Brexit, because that's what we have to work with, really. And it kind of dominates what people are panicking over, I guess. But you know, for the most part, I feel like they're trying to stand for something. Diplomatic and democratic and bigger than its separate parts, and that's what makes it like, you know, something that people can kind of aspire to. I don't know, I believe in it, that's why I'm here.
There was actually also another article that I read recently about Canada was negotiating a trade deal with a lot of European Union nations. That would allow Canada to trade with the Union without tariffs, so as if they were a part of the Union.
Right.
But the deal itself was being held up by Belgian local politics.
I think it fell through, actually.
Did it?
Yeah.
Well,
why Belgium?
Because they're like a huge provider of beef and agriculture in Europe. Or at least these specific regions of Belgium were. But if you give Canada the same access to the European market as Belgium does, Canada is a much larger market for beef than Belgium is. So these politicians were worried that their constituents would be put out of business by bigger Canadian agricultural industries.
Even if they had more... Even if they produce more beef, is it necessarily at a cheaper cost, especially if you have to fly it overseas?
Probably.
The costs are
not. Well, yeah, the costs would have been offset by the tariffs, so that's the reason why these Belgian farms can survive in the first place. But by giving Canada the same access as Belgium has, you're pretty much eliminating that, I guess, dissuasion. Which was weird, because I think even the Belgian Prime Minister pointed out that they had like 2 years to argue this point, and they just decided to bring it up like a week before the treaty was supposed to be signed. So, it's just stupid politics.
Really quickly, Alex, you're very opinionated and unusually quiet.
You are very opinionated. Let's go.
Honestly, I think the biggest issue to the EU is nothing that we've discussed tonight. A little bit. Brexit. The largest issue that I've been able to identify with the EU is the growing Eurosceptic Party, which is a party that literally believes the EU shouldn't be a thing. They feel that the independent nations work better as independent nations. Brexit just proved their point, because a major country can now just leave and be relatively okay. There's a dump in the value of the pound, and their economy is going to be wobbly for the next few years. Obviously, that's what happens when there's a major break from policy like this. But Britain will survive. At the end of the day, Britain will survive. So it's proving, to a greater or lesser extent, that it is possible for the EU to not necessarily exist.
But do you think it's really anti-EU, or is it the world kind of rejecting globalization all over again? Because I feel like this is happening everywhere, honestly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, it's happening in the United States. We just saw the Philippines break diplomatic ties with the U.S. and align with China and say that they are going to be in active talks with Russia. we're seeing a major shift in how globalization works.
The International Criminal Court is losing members.
They just lost South Africa, right?
Yeah, South Africa.
And like Namibia or something? Burundi.
I don't know. I'm sorry. Sorry I missed class today. I don't know. I think Euroscepticism is a symptom of a bigger problem. Like you said, the whole world seems to be rejecting globalization again. But if you reject globalization, then how does the EU have a foot to stand on? That would be my question. So if you don't necessarily combat this, what has grown out of a rejection of globalization on a systematic level, how do you ensure the survival of the European Union?
Well, I would even argue that, and I was going to bring up that Brexit was a bit of a threat to the integrity of the EU and everything, but you could argue that the UK itself is almost like an isolated case amongst the European Union.
The UK has never really gone with the flow when Europe tries to do anything.
Exactly. Right.
Ever. When Europe tries to unite, the UK says, well, we're an island, we're not really, we're European geographically, we see ourselves as British for our heritage.
I mean, that's been a thing since like
the Romans, basically.
Like, since, like, the European Coal and Steel Committee, and, like, their reluctance to initially join that. But, like, you also have, like, Alex was pointing out that, like, even, like, the president of France wants the EU to be, like, reformed and scaled back. And I didn't know this, but there are a lot of Euroskeptics in, like, parliamentary
They
positions.
Hold, what, 86 seats of the parliament, don't they?
In the UK?
In the EU parliament.
That's extreme.
I thought they own a significant margin of seats.
That sounds extreme. Like, why would you join a party and then be like, I hate everything you stand for, that's why I'm here?
How did Donald Trump become a Republican nominee?
Oh, snap. Yeah, right from the inside. Although I want to ask Alex, I mean, do you really see it being a threat that a lot of the smaller countries in the EU would actually threaten to leave? Because obviously, I agree with Evan that the UK would be an isolated case. That for the most part, most of the smaller nations wouldn't dare leave just because it's much more comforting to be part of this huge conglomerate.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely, you're not going to have a small nation that is benefiting the most up and leave just because the UK did. The UK isn't necessarily an isolated incident. Again, though, the point I was trying to make is, I feel like this is more the beginnings of a growing issue. The more that the EU becomes divided on different things, the refugee crisis, as all these things start to build, you're going to start to see more and more fractures in the system until it finally shatters.
Especially just because the UK actually leaving presents. Yeah, I agree with what you said. I think it's the beginning of a more cultural shift in how people see the EU. Nothing, like you said, nothing really happened to them. It wasn't that detrimental that they left. And even though it might not be beneficial for other countries to leave, they at least might not feel like they have to stay.
Right.
Which some people would argue is better if you feel that being part of the EU is something that benefits you, but also puts you in a state of like dependence to it, and that you kind of have to stay.
Right. I mean, Brexit was the first time that we've seen it actually happen, but how many times has there been a news blurb about a Brexit happening as Greece's economy shatters again and again and the EU has to bail them out? It's now it's not an impossibility.
It's a precedent.
Right.
But the issue with Greece is also that, not to say that a lot of people...
Greece is a completely different issue,
Yeah, everything about it was different, but... what was unfortunate for Greece is that there were a lot of people basically putting all of the EU's problems on their backs and saying, you were the one who brought us down into this mess. And even if Greece, obviously had some play in it. Their combi tanked and it did bring down the Euro. But well, here's another thing. You talk about all the Euro skepticists, but how much of them, or how many of them do you think have their views because of the fact that they don't think the EU should have been made in the first place? Not to necessarily say that it was a good idea, but now it's not. But how many of them do you think believe that it was never a good idea?
Wait, don't quote me on this. I am by no means a legitimate authority on EU politics. But I think it'd probably be pretty roughly half-half split between people who have always bucked the system and people who are now starting to buck the system.
So I feel what happened with Greece is that, and I had to do a project with this actually for Money Bank last year, but when they had to, because obviously when the EU was created, they set up guidelines